they have this technique of teaching Japanese that was almost cult-like. They were like, if you don't learn Japanese from us, you will never be able to speak Japanese correctly. But the problem with that is, over the phone, everybody thought I was a native speaker until I made a mistake, and then they just thought I was stupid. And so... So that also causes problems of its own. And especially when you tell them your name, they're like, namai wa nan desu ka? You're like, well, Springu de.
Springu de.
Anyone named Naino? Like, he's just like, Springu.
Were you not tempted to change your name to Harunohi? Like,
well, there's Harunohi, and then there's also Kasuga, which is the characters for Spring and Day together, which is quite a famous sumo wrestler's name.
The Rampton, that's the ball.
Hello, welcome to Comedy with an Accent podcast. I'm your Taiwanese comedian, Quan Wen. I interview comedians who perform English stand-up comedy but who are not native English speakers, or they can have a very distinct British regional accent. This podcast is all about comedy, about accent, about languages, and about the comedy technique. So stay tuned if you're interested.
Welcome back to the Comedy with an Accent podcast. If you have listened to any of our previous episodes before, you know that I, your Taiwanese comedian Quan Wen, do not really record a separate introduction at the start. I have to do one for this episode because the original recording, the first couple of 30 seconds was corrupted and it resulted in some really weird sound. I had to take the sound from the video recording. I did try to enhance it, but it sounded quite different, not quite as nice, I think. For some people with really sensitive ears, it might annoy them. However, the original recording, I started this episode in a specific way, so I needed to reserve that. So if you listen later and you don't like the sound of it, just skip about 35 seconds. It will come back to this normal quality. If not, let me know if you like the way I start the episode, and I hope you enjoy this episode.
皆さんこんにちは。
こんにちは皆さん。
アクセント付きコメディポッドキャストです。Sorry for my attempt at Japanese. You're still with the Comedy with an Accent podcast. And I had a Japanese greeting thanks to the help of Google Translate, obviously. But I did grow up with Japanese animation. It's not because I have a Japanese guest. In fact, my guests come from debatable source for this podcast. My guest is from Kansas City in
United States, America. But this lovely comedian has lived in Japan for a very long time. And actually, her comedy journey started with Tokyo Comedy Store, and she speaks fluent Japanese, which makes one of the un-American traits about her. I'm sure she'll be glad to hear that, because she once described being American as a disability, and don't worry about it, she is mildly disabled, so she can say things like that. Without further ado, can I introduce my guest today? That is Spring Day.
Hello, I'm Spring Day. Yoroshiku onegaishimasu.
That's proper Japanese, isn't it? I wasn't joking. It's funny, though. Like, sometimes when I have certain guests on, if I can master that language, I would do a short intro in a different language. I've done that in Italian and in French and with Spanish, which I don't speak, but I can easily pick it up. But they never seem as surprised as you did. Is it because you haven't been speaking Japanese for such a long time living in London?
It's been a long time. So I left Japan in 2015, and then I went through a period where I tried to get away from it completely.
What do you mean by getting away from it?
Well, I mean, being a foreigner in Japan, that kind of becomes your whole identity.
Gaijin,
you know, the outside person. And you have these little communities. And, you know, my whole life was about Japan. I worked for a Japanese company and I was performing to Japanese people. And
after how many years?
I was there for 16 years.
Despite all that, you are always an outsider, gaijin.
Oh, yeah. And that I sort of knew that was always going to be the case. But I thought there is this sort of community of people that are outsiders that make Japan their home. But what I found out is it's a lot like university, because a lot of these like work visas are either 1 year or 3 year or 5 year. So about every 3 years, I found that my friendship circle, everyone would just leave, and then I'd make new friends. And then you realize after the second or third cycle, oh, I'm just having the same conversations I had with my old friends who are now off, you know, in their home country or some other country. It was like I was in a university city for too long. Does that make sense?
Yes, I do think it's like what I would think in a fiction, how vampires see their life, you know, their lover have much shorter definite lifespan and they would just die. The vampire would just have to start like finding a new partner. And but I would have to say though, London isn't that different from it. Maybe it's different for you because you're now married.
Yeah.
So people can leave, but you have your partner to hold on to. So.
Yeah, I have my partner to hold on to.
And also, speaking of treating people always as an outsider, that's what English people excel at. I mean, they may appear to be your friends, but they are just your acquaintance. And
well, that's the other thing, too. Another thing is I feel really at home in the UK because being from America, living in Japan, like the UK has just the right level of passive aggressiveness for me. I feel very comfortable.
So who's worse?
What do you mean worse?
Worse does it mean like, it's ow, like it really hurts when you realize they are being passive aggressive because it's disguised so subtly.
It's very subtle to them.
Nihon, eh?
It's very subtle to them, but it's very blatant to me because I'm used to Japanese passive aggressiveness. So I'm like, oh, you think you're good at this. You're not. Like, this is very clear to me. So I wasn't completely comfortable with moving back to the States, which I did move back to the States for about a year. And moving from Tokyo to New York, that's the total reversal. Everyone's in your face. Everyone's very confrontational. And I was like, oh, in order for me to survive here, I'm going to have to change my personality.
Was it New York you had in mind when you went back to the States briefly?
New York. I was in New York.
Yeah, so maybe that's a more New Yorker thing, right? Being quite aggressive and confrontational.
But it's also, in its own way, it's very nice. So, for example, I was talking to a friend on the train and a woman yelled at me. She's like, get off. And I was like, why? She said, it's your stop. Yeah. And she'd been listening to our conversation and realized that if she didn't tell us, we were going to miss her stop.
Oh, and, but say, do you think it's better than someone say, well, some foreigners just never know manners, do they? Which one? It's more annoying.
Well, it really depends on my mood. You know what I mean? Some things that people do in Japan, you'd never put your feet up on the seat, ever. And if you do, you take your shoes out first.
Yes.
Right? And that's just common courtesy.
Yeah.
But I feel like what's happened to me is, as an outsider, I've been able to sort of pick and choose things about cultures that I like and try to adopt.
Uh-huh.
But that's also happened subconsciously.
Japanese culture a la carte.
Yes. Yeah. But also there's other subconscious thing that I just think everyone does and it's not. And so I find myself getting really offended by stuff no one else gets offended by.
I think I'm driving the conversation too soon into the cultural difference in Japan without properly introducing you. So
it's okay.
Spring is the standard TV program Life of the Apollo Star. Actually, your episode is going to be on BBC Two tonight.
Yeah. Rebroadcast, the shorter version.
So I really love Spring. She's one of the loveliest people, grammatically. She's one of the loveliest people I know in London on the comedy circuit. But when we talk about her being on the podcast, because I love her, I just say, I don't think that fits the brief. And we had a gentle debate about it.
Understand. Yeah.
I've done an episode recently with Daphna, who wrote a dissertation on first generation immigrant comedians in the UK.
Mm.
One question I raised that you heavily features Americans. And I do think maybe it's because I'm doing this podcast on accent. I really focus on sort of acoustically. Americans still have it slightly easier than people from elsewhere, either where their mother tongues are not English or where they are from a very different culture to try to blend in. I mean, because of the globalized age, people do understand America to a point. And we finally set on this episode because of Spring's very long journey living and actually starting her comedy in Tokyo. But now let's address it. Am I being too narrow-minded on this? Like when I first say, I don't think that fits my brain, what was your first reaction to that?
That made sense to me. Like, it's really important when you're doing a podcast to know exactly what it's about. And I started thinking about one of the reasons I moved to Japan was from a very young age, I was always sort of baffled by American centralism, like culturally and like we're the best, you know, it kind of rang of like the high school team going, we're the best football team ever. And you're like, what do you know? You're 13 and you've never been anywhere else. And this sort of school spirit and this sort of patriotism that I just thought was kind of silly.
Mm.
I was very fortunate. When I was very young, I met people from other countries. And I think they were like cool Peace Corps types that were traveling. And they were telling me of all these cool places they went. And they were also like super nice to me. And it all seemed like an adventure. And it was like, this is... And outside of America, it just sounded so much more interesting and also seemed a lot more civil and curious. And that just sparked my curiosity. I understand any sort of trying to get away from America being the center of the earth.
Yeah.
We need less of that. And we need more perspectives, more different things. I can understand why people would think, well, I guess since people perceive stand-up being from America, why that might
Some conservative British would probably have a problem with that statement. But I did have a good think about this when I tried to reprogram, rephrase, because normally I have a flow how I ask the questions. And my standard question usually is, do you think you have an accent? And that would work very differently in today's episode. But I did think that you're right. I just have to retrain myself. You're a guest I'm so lucky to have on. I just have to change my approach to invite you to share what my listeners are most interested in. Does that make sense to you? Because my initial reaction when you asked me, I didn't see you as a person despite our friendship. Can I say that?
Yes, sure.
I still saw you first and foremost as an American comic. So my history of being annoyed by various American comics were unfairly imposed on you. Let me give an example. When some American acts used to ask me, can I be on because I have an accent too? I feel like it's like Victoria Beckham say she's working class in that documentary Beckham. Or a rich girl joining, I don't know, a group saying that they are underprivileged. And she didn't say, well, I'm underprivileged too because mommy didn't allow me to have a pony. So this that's the kind of thing why I'm thinking. Because when I started, I thought I want my guests to share how they were pigeonholed or how they were judged just because their accent doesn't come naturally to the ears of British audience. And I do think that as we live in a globalized age and it's the special relationship America has with Britain, for British audience, yes, you do sound like you're not from here, but you can, I don't know, bridge quite seamlessly. Maybe there's a bit of challenge, but it's not that much a challenge. And when I had this discussion with Daphna, obviously, she doesn't just look at the sound of the comedian. She has to look at the background history, the persona. So it makes sense for her to include lots of Americans because in a way, you guys are immigrants too. Although more debatable, maybe you are expats and immigrant is reserved for
people. Well, no, I wouldn't qualify myself as an expat because I don't work for a company that's paying into a pension that's giving me a salary big enough to live exactly as I would live if I lived in the States. Because like when I moved to Japan, I didn't realize that a lot of middle class kids go to Japan to teach English for a summer as kind of like a gap year thing. I just thought, well, no, you get a job in another country. That's your job for the rest of your life. Like that's sort of true.
I remember having a casual fling with a university professor in Taipei when I was quite young. Yeah. That professor was from France. So he say, let's come back to my place. We hung on to a cab and he just took out a little note, like he wrote his address and show it to the cab. And I asked him quite shocked, like, how long have you been living in Taiwan by that point? He said 20 years. And I said, after 20 years, you couldn't even use Mandarin to tell someone where you live? And then we, people in Taiwan, put up with that shit. We just think it was possible and allow these expats to never learn. And it basically it comes down to this. I thought, okay, you do speak American English, but you speak fluent Japanese and you open yourself up and trying to learn the country you were living and that marks you in a different category.
Well, I majored in Japanese. I studied abroad. I lived with a Japanese family for a year. Yeah.
So would you say your Japanese is, are you still capable of, how do they say it? Pera pera shaberu.
Pera pera shaberu. Shaberareru.
I was trying to bypass by saying "できますか?" So spit.
まあ話せるだけど、まあ言いたい言葉はたまには欲しい言葉は出てこない. So I can't really say everything I really want to say exactly how I want to say it. And I think what's really frustrating about
it's like takusan dango wasurejatta.
単語とかでも喋り方も違います. The way you talk in Japanese is very different because Japanese is very high context.
Define high context?
High context. English is very low context in comparison. So the speaker is responsible for being clear with their message.
Yeah.
Where in Japan, in Japanese, the listener is responsible for decoding the message.
Oh, so you'll be like, decipher me.
Decipher me. So it's really hard to argue in Japanese because no one's saying anything really clearly. They're just inferring everything. Yeah. And you'd be like, well, you said this. And I didn't say anything. I think the art of speaking Japanese is the art of speaking incomplete sentences and just being really mysterious. Like, I passed the test you need to pass in order to work for Japanese companies in Japanese. But I would say at any given time, I only understood 70% of what was going on.
Especially when you work in office, you're supposed to use another more elevated level, the keigo, is that right?
Keigo, yeah.
Yeah, so there's a different, how do you call it, like a tense? Like,
there's a different, yeah, it's a... It's,
you have to conjugate layer. Your verbs once again differently. You actually have to use different verbs sometimes to make you sound more educated, politer, more respectful for others. And for some of the younger Japanese people, they simply could not speak this version of Japanese sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. This is the longest time I've started without asking the proper question, but I'm not sure which language I should ask you first. So let's say, do you think when you speak English, you have an accent?
I do. I know I do because it changes all the time. So when I worked in Japan and I moved to Japan when I was 20, 21, most of the other people that I knew were British. And
oh.
Because they have passports and they travel. Like less than 20% of Americans have passports and they don't really travel that much. So you sort of mimic how they talk. And also...
It was unintentional though, when you say you mimic
a little bit. Thing is that I was trying to find myself. I was trying to become my own person and I really hated my hometown and I really hated everything about where I grew up. So I was trying to create a new persona for myself. If I could have Rachel Dolezal'd, I would have.
So you're trying to reinvent yourself.
Yeah, yeah.
What was the reference you used, Rachel?
So Rachel Dolezal is the American woman that passed herself off as African-American.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that you know, bitch.
But if you know her story, if you watch the documentary, she came from a very traumatic religious household, and they had adopted several children from Africa, and they were very abusive. But she was in charge of raising her siblings.
Right.
And so I think that she created this persona to differentiate herself from her white abusive parents and being like, no, we're siblings. And so she latched onto this culture that seems very inclusive and joyous and all this great art and stuff. And she got the hair right. I was trying to do that. Like, I dyed my hair black. Everyone thought I was a goth. But I was like, no, I'm just trying to be Japanese. Like,
as an American girl from Kansas City
yeah.
And then went golf in Japan. I mean, it sounds like a very niche premises of a sitcom. I don't know.
No, it was all...
But you know what you said about Rachel Dolezal.
Dolezal. Yeah.
Thank you for that piece of information. It's interesting. You didn't know the background, but I still think she crossed the line.
She did. She absolutely did. But she's very uneducated and not a lot of resources for help. And she just used what was around her and it's like, oh, that's a lifeboat. She took
it
too
partially
far.
You can sympathize with her because you can see a bit of your sort of family story. I mean, not completely,
but
Spring had a wonderful show last year at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival called Exvangelical. She talks about she was basically lured in a cult for a very long time. And they basically took advantage of you, but you were young and naive and thinking they had your best interests at heart.
Yeah, I think that they believed that they did too. I don't think that they were malicious. I think they believed it and they continue to believe it.
And I think that makes them worse. Story of why you moved to Tokyo was fascinating. If I'm not wrong, you say that's because one of your good friend's grandma was Japanese and you were heavily brainwashed in the cult and you really want to become a priest only to be told that no, it's not a job for women.
A preacher.
So you thought, okay, I will be a missionary. So you were looking and you didn't really get a job, but then say you're set on moving to Japan anyway, because your friend said Tokyo is a big city, is safe and public transport's great. And because of a disability and because of this friend's sort of grandma's origin, you end up in... It's so random. I just love how random the whole thing is.
Well, that's the thing.
Because that's a decision that alters your whole life's journey. You may not necessarily have started doing comedy if you were not... Because I'd imagine when you were living in Tokyo, you would feel that solitude a little bit more accentuated. And you would go to do things where English-speaking people can enjoy together. And there are not a lot of them. And comedy typically is a popular choice for English-speaking expats in a foreign city.
Mm-hmm. But this was a long, long time ago. This was before the comedy boom.
Yes. Right?
At the time, when I moved to Tokyo, I didn't really have any money. I was staying at a guest house that was run by a bunch of Japanese lesbians who... You know, it was like 8 people to a room. And I was like, well, what am I going to do while I'm waiting for this work visa to come through? And there was like this free English language newspaper called The Metropolis at the time. There was like an ad, like, do you want to do comedy? There's an open mic night in Takaranobaba. And there was this pub that some British guy ran. And
British again.
Yeah, it was a British guy. And it was in the basement of this university town pub. And it was free. Well, this seems like something I can spend time on, writing stuff. And it won't cost me anything because I don't have any money to
so
do it.
So it's the Japanese bureaucracy that prompts you into the world of comedy.
Kind of. Well, it's something I always wanted to do. But when I was in university, I was working full-time in, you know, restaurants and stuff. So I didn't really have a life outside of
school. So you studied comedy before your jobs at that time, which was to teach Japanese businessmen English.
Yes, that's correct.
So now following that question, 日本語 話す時。 アクセントがありますか？
あのね、私の日本語のアクセントは、だいぶネイティブっぽい。Yeah. So my accent, especially back then, because I started studying Japanese at 13.
Yeah. Just in case people don't know, I asked her, you probably could have guessed, I was asking her in Japanese whether she has an accent when she speaks Japanese. Okay, sorry.
Okay, so because I started so early and I went to like a very full-on Japanese camp.
In Missouri?
No. So my Japanese teacher, she told me about this chance. It was like a 6-week Japanese boot camp in Ohio. And I saved all my money to do this.
I'm sorry, thing. Of all the state, Ohio.
In Ohio, yeah.
Ohio.
Ohio. Ohio gozaimasu. I met some really good friends there, but they have this technique of teaching Japanese that was almost cult-like. They were like, if you don't learn Japanese from us, you will never be able to speak Japanese correctly. But they were really full on, like, you have to have a native accent or you're going to sound like an idiot.
Yeah.
Which I don't agree with anymore.
But you do sound, I think it's pretty good.
Yeah,
you don't sound like watashi wa.
Oh, yeah, no. So like I spent hours and hours at the little disc thing repeating things until the teacher said I was doing a good job. Like I had to do the nari-ru-de, which is like a cross between R and L and a D and all that kind of stuff until I perfected it. But the problem with that is over the phone, everybody thought I was a native speaker until I made a mistake and then they just thought I was stupid. And so, so that also causes problems of its own. And especially when you tell them your name, they're like, namai wa nan desu ka? You're like, well, Springu de. And you're like,
Springu de.
Named Naino. Like, and you're just like, Springu.
Were you not tempted to change your name to Haru no Hi?
Well, there's Haru no Hi, and then there's also Kasuga, which is the characters for Spring and Day together, which is quite a famous sumo wrestler's name.
The Renton, I suppose.
There's a few streets named Kasuga, and I thought, you know, if I ever started a production company, I'd probably call it Kasuga or something like that. But I've thought about changing my name to Kasuga, and I was like, no, that doesn't sound like I'm a white native English speaker.
Like, I do wonder, though, Japanese for English speaker to learn, because Japanese has so many what they call the gairaigo, like the foreign origin or introduced words. Yeah. It's basically most of the time English spoken with a Japanese phonology or accent.
Well, that's the thing. Like, I used to do a lot of conversations between me and a Japanese person, and I would do the Japanese accent. Mm. And to the other American accents and foreign accents, they would
think
say,
you're just being offensive.
They say you're being racist. Where the Japanese audience would say, oh, you're speaking clearly. They're like, oh, we understand how you speak.
Because I thought that must be difficult. It's a struggle to just do it in a way. You see something, and once you're reminded that, oh, that's actually that word in your language, to force yourself to pronounce in a way that's not how you usually do it is actually quite difficult. If people pay attention when I say comedy with an accent, comedy is comedy, something like that.
And,
an accent, I thought the accent would be ben, because when you say west of the Honshu, called Kansai ben. But I think modern Japanese like to use the foreign word accento to say accent. Yeah. And podcast is podcasto. So when you are used to saying like podcast, and when you speak Japanese, you have to force to say, because you know the word, you're halfway there. But that's which must be difficult.
Well, no, what's difficult is when I remember I was taking a Japanese spelling test, and the word for eclair, the donut thing. Well, where I'm from, we don't call them eclairs; we call them longfoot.
You mean eclair, like the
eclair donut? You know, and I was like, I had no idea what they were talking about. And they're like, you know, eclairs. Eclairs, eclair. And I was like, I don't know what you're talking about, your fancy donuts. Like,
that's the reason that I stopped learning Japanese.
Yeah.
Japanese was actually, so after English, which is compulsory for everyone, Japanese was the first other foreign language I attempted. And I thought it would be like cheating because Japanese used so many sort of what they call kanji, you know, Chinese characters. So it would be easy for me to get into. But I realized that actually they are ditching the Chinese characters and they're using a lot more foreign introduced words.
Yeah.
So when they already have daitokoro for kitchen, modern Japanese like to use kitchen. And I just thought, I was feeling my English was getting worse because of learning Japanese. And I also feel like, no, you don't actually use that many Chinese characters anymore. So then I just stopped doing it.
Well, it's so funny because I remember if we were in the same Japanese class, I would have hated you. Yeah. Because when we were studying the kanji, which we had, this was before.
It was the toughest for non-Asian language learners.
Yeah. And then people from, you know, Taiwan and stuff, they'd just be like, yeah. Okay. All right. Because like, I sort of missed the way you guys were taught characters, because you get all the like why the picture looks like this,
and we get it stroke by stroke, and we practice so much in our childhood.
Yeah. That drove me crazy, and I never got quite as good at kanji as I wanted to be. But then again, I also
that makes you more Japanese. I think modern Japanese are like you anyway. You actually performed in Japanese before.
I did.
How many times?
I'd say somewhere between 5 and 10 times, because I wanted to be funny in a specific way. But in order for that to happen, because I'm not a native speaker, I worked with a friend of mine's husband who was a funny guy, but he had like a regular day job. And what is so difficult is that a lot of Japanese speakers feel very responsible for presenting a good front for Japan. They don't want Japan to look bad.
And they wouldn't appreciate you mocking.
Well, you'd write something that was wrong, but it was funny because it was wrong. And she'd be like, no, you don't say it like that. It doesn't make any sense. I said, I know it doesn't make any sense, but it doesn't make sense in a funny way.
Can you give me an example of that?
I had this bit about how I went to a Japanese wedding, and when you say I do in Japan, you say chikaimasu, which means I vow. But it also sounds exactly the same as chigaimasu, which means no. And so I didn't understand why these two people getting married were just saying no to each other. And she was just like, but they're not saying no, they're saying chikai. And I was like, yeah, but that's the funny bit. And she thought, she's like, well, no, but the correct thing is, I said, no, we'll get to that later.
So that limits your audience to Japanese-speaking foreigners then?
Well, no, just limits who you can write with, right? So, I mean, this person wasn't a comedy person, but this guy got it, you know, and he was a very funny guy, but he'd also lived abroad a little bit. He understood what I was going for. The economic options for a foreign comedian such as myself, the way I came in, it was never going to be a lucrative enough job for him to quit his job, so I was like, I'll just focus on the English then.
What's the literal translation of it? Because Japanese is famous as a language to have all the different ways to be replacement for no. It's almost impossible to get a Japanese to directly say no to you.
Well, chikaimasu means different. It's different.
Yes.
So it's not saying no directly. It's saying, actually, it's just different.
God. And the other thing I remember is the Japanese sentence structure. The word order is so different. When you do your misdirection, a lot of people, a simple misdirection is on the temporal adverb at the end. So sorry for jumping into grammatical term, but what I mean that instead of say tomorrow, it will be yesterday. And sometimes you can play around structure. For example, you can say that, oh, I just married, and you would say something at the end when people are expecting my wife. You didn't say my father, for example.
Yeah.
That's why. But Japanese sentence structure is so different. If you do your misdirection in this way, your same job wouldn't work in a language.
It wouldn't work.
I think your misdirection typically is a misdirection of ideas.
Yeah.
So you probably were not that restricted by the grammatical or language differences.
Well, so I really feel, though, that having started and done stand-up in Japan for so long, it really shaped it. So I couldn't do those things that non-native speakers wouldn't be able to follow.
What do you mean? Can you elaborate a little bit? How
did
you shape
you? I had my joke about Little Orphan Annie, how much I love that movie. And I loved it so much that when adults asked me what I wanted to be when I grew up, I'd say orphan. It was just like that word is not commonly enough used for that to really punch. So they don't really know what an orphan is because they don't really talk about orphans.
Oh.
You know, it's just kind of a taboo topic. So it's a really funny joke everywhere else, but it's not going to go in Japan. Also, too, I noticed that I spoke really slowly in Japan.
You do, yeah.
Yeah, and that's so that all the non-native speakers can understand. And until I moved to the UK, it just sounded like I had been in a car accident. And then, you know, and people weren't approaching me about it because they're like, well, maybe that's part of the cerebral palsy. It's like, no, I've been talking to non-native speakers my entire adult life. It just slows you down.
You had to speak like a beginner to intermediate level of like an English teaching podcast to non-native English speakers.
Yes. Yeah. And I sort of limited my vocabulary to almost like a Dr. Seuss level.
Mm.
And like, okay, this is what we've got. This is what I understand that they will understand.
So now that you're away from Japan for so long, have you deliberately tried to introduce more, slightly more difficult words in your comedy routines?
I think so. And that has a lot to do with talking to my husband, who's a native English speaker, and his family. They're all readers and all this sort of stuff. I feel like, oh, yeah, okay. I get to use
your liberating words from the cage.
But I've also learned that my speech pattern in English is very Japanese. So I often say things twice. I often say things twice, like,
which you just did, but it's because I wanted to be closer to the microphone.
No, but I would say sure, I know, let's go,
like, you know, just now I say that whether you speak Japanese fluently, and I use the expression pera pera. And Japanese has a lot of those. What's the term for that?
Onomatopoeias.
Is that a Japanese word or English word?
It's an English word.
But it's not like Japanese.
It was my favorite book that my host family had. Mm. Was just a book of onomatopoeias. Mm. They have so many. They're so great. Like, the onomatopoeia for opening a sliding door is gotta, 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 gotta.
Yeah, Japanese manga will use a lot of those to explain what's going on visually.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a specific expression for how the door is opening. You are eating something crunchy or chewy.
Yeah.
And how you sort of slurp. You have all those sort of things. So when they translate a Japanese manga into Mandarin, they will always also translate those little sounds being used to describe the background. It becomes a my thing when I do my comedy clips on Reels. And that's why I don't outsource the editing, because I find a lot of video editors here in Britain don't get what I want, because I grew up reading Japanese mangas and I want to use all those. I couldn't even pronounce that word. Can you introduce to the audience three of your favorite?
Oh, three of my favorite. So the sound for the onomatopoeia word for licking is pedo pedo. I think. Yeah, I think it's pedo pedo.
But as like a dog licking, cat licking food, or someone licking another person?
Yeah, I would see it like outside what they call health clubs, but they're like, I don't know, hand job shops or something. These sort of like quasi sex shops always had like cartoon pieces of fruit on it, usually like a cut watermelon or a couple of cherries or tomatoes. And you're like, I guess that's sexual, but if, and it always says like health club in English on it. And you're like, oh, wow, this place is really healthy. And then you're like, oh, okay, all right.
Pero pero is leaking, but pera pera is to speak a language fluently.
Pickle pickle is the sound your stomach makes when it's empty.
Aww. Eating something crunchy, what would it be?
Kachi kachi? Maybe? I don't know.
Let's text Yuriko after this.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I could be wrong about any of those, but I mean, just off the top of my head, I think.
I didn't notice when you say your speech pattern has been influenced by Japanese. That's so interesting.
Well, I think when I was a kid, I thought, well, I'll just shortcut and I'll just change the way I speak English so that when I learn Japanese, it'll be easier.
But it's funny because you have a penchant for darker gags.
Yeah, but Japanese people are very dark. Like if I went to listen to Rakugo, you know, this is very traditional comedic storytelling. It's all just outhouse jokes and reverse domestic violence. Like, it's those are the stories that stand the test of time. If you listen to Japanese folk music, it's all like, my husband kicked me down the stairs, but I love him. Like, you know.
Didn't know about that, but I do know traditional Taiwanese song comes from the Japanese tradition of enga.
Enga.
And it's always talking about someone dying or someone being abandoned. Nothing good ever happens to those people. So I remember asking my grandma, why are all those songs you listen to so sad?
Yeah. And so my host family with the biggest smile on their faces as well. And it's just the singing, the darkest, like, I took a Japanese literature class and I hated it so much.
These twisted people.
Because, like, all of this, there's no hope at the end. Like, everything, and they're like, oh, by the way, everybody dies and nothing goes the way you wanted it to. And you're like, what's the point of reading this book?
Shocked to find out that Kansas City is in Missouri.
Well, it's a...
You know, there's a One Friends episode when they tried to complete the 50 states, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And I kept doing that quiz when I was younger. And I always miss one or two in the middle of one of the Bible Belt ones, always missing. But I thought when I check on your information and you say you're from the suburb of Kansas City, Missouri, and I'm pretty sure there's a state called Kansas. And I would imagine Kansas City is in Kansas, but no, Kansas City...
There are two.
Oh!
There are two. There's Kansas City, Kansas, and Kansas City, Missouri. It is split by the river, and all of the factories and stuff is on the Kansas side, and all the fun stuff is on the Missouri side.
Why? Who designed this?
The river.
No, because when you have a division like this, normally is on the German and Polish border. You know, like one of the old German city was given to Poland and then they're now different side of the country, so they had to become two different cities. America wasn't invaded in the middle, and you designed somehow to lay the state border across two organic parts of a city?
No, I could be wrong, but I'm pretty sure it has something to do with racism in the Civil War. But like,
let one side for the black people, one side for the white people.
So this is.
Oh my God, this is getting so juicy.
So, okay. Kansas was a free state, and I think Missouri was kind of like after the Civil War was over, they continued to fight for years because no one wanted to believe it was over and that they lost.
And that's like, the state you're from.
Yeah.
And yet you say that's where the fun side is.
No, it is fun because everybody's idiots. I mean, that's why I wanted a whole new identity.
You have to stop tapping on the...
Oh, sorry,
the,
sorry,
because they will create a sound.
Oh, sorry.
It definitely disrupted the fun energy we had. So they are to Kansas City. You're from Kansas City, Missouri, but you're from the Bible Belt.
I am from the Bible Belt, from the buckle bit. Yeah.
So the question is, though, people in America, can they tell by your accent, knowing that you're from the Bible Belt?
No, well, if I talk
to my dad...
It is
Missouri Southern.
No. There is a particular Midwestern accent that is not Southern.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, we say birthday instead of birthday.
Like, so you shorten the TH sound.
Yeah. And we go library instead of library. And just like the syntax a little bit different. I remember my aunt, she said, I guess they use a different vernacular over there now, don't they? And to me, like the use of the word vernacular is very Midwestern. I don't really hear.
The way you say that sentence, yeah. I just picture a rifle next to your auntie being laid on the porch. Am I being judgmental?
No, but there are sheep in the picture.
Who may or may not be shagged by a farmer nearby. Sorry, that's inappropriate. Okay, the question is now, outside USA, can people tell you're from a certain part of USA or you just be lumped into the generic American accent?
I think that I get lumped in, but I can tell which part of America people are from.
Yeah, but the audience. I'm talking
about
when you're the performer. But okay, let's say it would be disingenuous when I do the Beyonce y'all, because that's not really how you speak. Speak in Missouri. No. That's more thousand, right?
I mean, there's just a different levels of twang. So when I talk to my dad for 10, 15 minutes, it'll come back. And I'll be like, well, I got to take a shower. I got to wash your dishes. You know, it's just a little bit of that. And then the rest of it sounds kind of standard, but there's just a little bit of that.
Because I rarely ask American acts about this, that when you speak, you come across generic American.
Yeah.
I think probably New Yorker or Californian or people from American South can be defined further, but you are just a generic American, right?
Yeah.
Do you feel you have to adjust your persona or explain your persona in a certain way because of your accent? Because I think you tend to address your disability first.
Yeah.
Do you feel like you have to explain, or does that influence how you picture or design that stage persona, your accent specifically?
When I'm in a situation where I'm being filmed and I'm concerned about going too fast because I'm nervous, I will lean into my accent.
Oh, because, can you give me an example?
So that's what I did with Live at the Apollo, because I watched a lot of other great acts. I could see them panic and they talk too fast. They were telling dark jokes and it's kind of like, well, if I say it really fast, it'll be over with. And also the timing feels weird because it's such a big audience. And
you have to wait for the laughter to ripple through the room and then you start speaking again.
Exactly. Yeah. So I thought, well, if I lean in to my hometown accent, that'll slow everything down. And then I'll relax into it. And so at the beginning of that set, it was super strong. And then I sort of transitioned out of it by the end. I was like, oh, okay, here's the pace.
That's so interesting. But is it because your hometown accent itself has this longer pause between sentences? Or is it because you feel a little bit more at ease with it and it helps you to calm the nerve?
A little bit of both, really. When I first moved to the UK, I just told everyone I was from New York because I thought, well, then they'll take me more seriously because New York is, you know, a home of stand-up comedy. And then I realized, you know, there's enough voices from New York and I don't sound like I'm from New York.
Yeah.
There's not as many people that are from the town that I'm from that aren't rich that are talking. And so I thought, well, best to lean on that because it'll sort of ring true.
I think so too. Like hardly anyone has experience of living on the same street with serial killer. So I do think that. I mean, you couldn't get more stereotypical of your story from Kansas City, Missouri.
It's so funny. The problem with the Midwest is that there's enough space that you don't have to learn how to get along with everyone.
You don't have to socialize.
I knew people that would walk around naked in front of their house because they knew no one could see them. I just feel like Kansas City seems like a nice, quiet town. And then it just makes up for lost time when there's crime. Just last month, a woman, she was picked up by a paramedic, you know, ambulance, and then she stabbed the paramedic to death. All the news is like, you know, this poor paramedic, he was such a hero to the community. And I'm like, yeah, that's all fine and good. But what happened? What happened? What's going on? Why are you acting like this is Tuesday?
Well, you did Rich Wilson's podcast.
Yeah.
You explained that your family knew I'm a serial killer so well before their doors were on earth. Someone say that Robert blah, blah, blah was a serial killer and you responded, oh, you mean Bob? I thought that was hilarious. I think that not a lot of American acts here in London can share that kind of story.
But I do think that when you live in the countryside and you think, oh, I'm in a safe place, and you're like, no, you're not, because you're still living with people.
You're still living people amongst people who don't need to socialize.
Did I tell the other story? So the Bob Berdella story is really funny because every time Bob Berdella comes up in the news, which he sometimes does, my dad would be like, oh, I never liked him. Terrible conversation. There was another guy that went to his gym that got caught with two dead women in his trunk. Mm. When that came out in the news, my dad went, oh, what did he go and do that for? He's a good-looking fella. Doesn't seem to need to be the kind of guy to go and do something like that. Jeez. I feel like you're angry about the wrong thing, Dad.
Do you know when you were telling that story? I have it in my... I think some comics may have attempted to make that a character.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They could lean in on your father's way of talking and what he is as a person and sort of reinvented someone that's not even an exaggerated version of you, because I think you've lived abroad for so many years. That would not be authentically you.
No, but I feel like he's a representative of what I would have become if I hadn't left.
But comedically, was there any temptation to do that kind of act? As in, you basically become a parody of a certain kind of Americans. Was that ever in a pipeline of a kind of comedy you would do?
I'll be like a character actor of, like, basically the cable guy or something like that. No. Because I'm not a character actor. I feel like I'm a storyteller.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like I grew up surrounded by various forms of mental illness. One parent who had severe ADHD, and then, you know, another parent who's drowning in trauma. You are the person who has a pretty neurotypical brain talking about what it's like to live in the center of that tornado. I feel like that is something that other people can relate to and we don't hear much of. Does that make sense?
Yes. I feel like if such portrayal would be almost an exploitation, almost like a victim porn in a way, because you don't see and you don't try to explain the nuances that how it came to this place.
Yeah.
You're just showing what's on surface. But what would you feel if you see a fellow act? Maybe let's say who's not even an American, who's not from that kind of background, portraying a character like that.
Well, it's interesting because I'll watch it, but it's also what they're trying to achieve, because sometimes you can do that and they can hit the right note. When I first visited UK just on vacation, like in 2003, I went to a few open mic nights and there were a couple of acts that were pretending to be stupid Americans. And they were just really offensive. But the thing is, I thought that they were just stupid Americans. Like, I mean, it wasn't funny at all.
But were those acts Americans or British?
They were British. And I talked to them after they got off the stage. I honestly thought they were American. I just thought they were being belligerent and, you know, and da-da-da-da. And talking to them, I could see that they put a lot of energy in creating this character. And I was like, but it's too good. You're too on the nose. It needs to be a little bit off.
So it doesn't really offend you in a way, not so much.
No, it's very difficult to offend me in an artistic space. If you're off stage and you're in my face and you're saying all that stuff and it's not for entertainment, I'll be angry. But there's very, very little that upsets me on stage because I understand that people have an idea and they need to be given the space to fail.
Perform English stand-up comedy in Tokyo.
Mm-hmm.
Can I assume the majority of your audience is one Japanese locals?
I'd say at least half.
Okay.
I'd say at least half were Japanese people who spoke English really well, or they lived abroad, or they didn't quite fit in, or they were scholars.
To that mixed crowd, what were your subject matters? Mostly about your life in Japan? Your observation of Japan as a foreigner?
I used to have this joke about how people would come up to me and just start talking to me at the station, say what they wanted to say, and then leave. And I'd be like, well, I feel like I should have charged them for a quickie.
But what, like, do they say? Like, America should stop invading other countries?
No, they'd just be like, hi, my name is, this is my job.
Oh, you are the free English practice.
Free English practice. And then occasionally I'd be in a cafe. And I remember somebody was doing a presentation on dental cement in Europe. And they came to me and they said, I'll buy you a cup of coffee. Can you proofread this for me?
Well, talking about being indirect, I don't think that's...
Well, no, but that's the other thing, because they know that we are not as indirect as they are. They
so
they
not
are...
all Japanese rules apply. And they can be the rule breakers because you're not a domestic object.
Yeah, so we're outside the system. And a lot of Japanese doctors, because going to a therapy or a psychiatrist or psychologist is considered shameful, the doctors will say, go study English. Just in English. And so I would have disgruntled employees or unhappy people telling me their life story. And I'd be like, you are not is suicidal. You are suicidal. Like, you know, like so I, you know, that sort of. Like,
but then when you start teaching the Japanese businessman English, did half of it become like a therapy session in the end?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Oh my God.
Well, I thought the most interesting cases, occasionally rich kids who'd screwed up would get sent to America. Rich parents could tell their friends, oh, our kid's studying in America. And so this one guy I taught, he was like 19 or 20. He'd gone to LA. He'd gotten mixed up in with some gangs. And he just talked like a gangster. Like he talked like a full, like it was all grammatically correct, but he didn't have the English that would be suitable for like a job. So he'd be like, yo, man, I'm just so tired, dude. Like, my parents are crawling all upside my ass. And I'm like, it's just like, well, this is all grammatically correct, but, you know, you can't work for Nissan talking like this.
Like, yo, bro, gonna buy the car or not?
So, you know, it'd be sort of talking about that, like the way men would approach me on the street. I tell these stories about how these businessmen would come up to me, like, in a bookstore and then, like, gesture, like, hey, do you want to... You know, with fingers in the hole. And I just went, no, like this very Japanese no. And they went, and then they just walk away. You know, just these sort of.
So blunt, but so polite in the end.
But also it just says, oh, you only know foreign women through the porn you see. Because to me, that's a very porn
scenario.
I want
to say Japan doesn't comes up well in your portrayal.
Well, no, I mean, every place is weird. Every country's weird. Everyone's got their outsiders. And so as an outsider that's obviously an outsider, you're going to attract more outsiders that feel like outsiders. So I wouldn't say that's the norm, because the norm wouldn't talk to me or interact with me.
But is it true, I think when you were based in Japan, you did come to the UK very often.
I did.
A lot of summers to do the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. So the transition wasn't abrupt, that you basically you phase in. When you made your move to the UK, your audience changed. For you, was there a noticeable shift or a very big bang?
It's a huge shift for me because I had to find out who I was outside of Japan. Because my identity up until then had been, I'm this foreign, short, white girl that can't get a date, who's got, you know, disability and everything. And then trying to live my life in Japan, and I was there for the long term. And then when I realized, oh, this isn't going to happen, I wanted to have a family of my own. I wanted to have a life outside Japan. I'd seen what had happened to people that stayed 20, 30, 40 years. And I was like, I think I kind of want to avoid that. So then I was like, okay, well, I can't really talk about having lived in Japan in the UK.
Because, not a lot of people are that interested in
Well,
Japan.
No, it's just, it's too shiny. Because like, when you're in Japan, complaining about living in Japan is, everybody does that. And it's a shared emotion. Complaining about Japanese people or Japanese culture in the UK just sounds racist because your audience is different and they don't have a shared experience. So I was like, okay, my audience is predominantly UK. How do I include them in my conversation? Who am I here? And what am I here? I think it took me a couple of years to figure out what I could talk about and also who I wanted to be.
But the starting point of those, wouldn't that be evident when you were here during the festival? Because already during Fringe Festival, you weren't talking to people who live in Japan or who are from Japan. So surely some of this material would start to trickle down or?
Well, no, but I learned my first couple years of doing Edinburgh that, oh, these people aren't Japanese. And I thought that because I lived in Japan, I was international. So I feel like Meghan Markle was like, I can live in the UK because I've lived in Canada. Like, I know what's up. Having the very rare experience of having lived a significant amount of your life in a third country, you go, oh, it's a new ball game altogether.
Is London home?
Yes, it is.
I thought it would be.
Yeah.
And I thought, because you're describing, even though you stay in Japan for such a long time, the distinction between the outsiders mm-hmm. and the non-outsider is so big. I feel I'm always a little bit of outsider, but that sense is not that strong. I mean, it's not that protruding. And in a way, when I go back to my home country now, I feel more foreign. Mm-hmm. And also it's weird because I'm used to being the minority in a big international multiracial city. And I went back to a rather homogenous, I'm just like everyone else. That feeling is really, really weird.
Yeah.
And from your point of view, I guess you are such a distinct outsider mm-hmm. in terms of your ethnicity, in terms of your nationality. In London, people probably are used to seeing American immigrants here and there, as in, if you go to a coffee shop and there's someone serving the coffee, speaks American accent, you wouldn't even raise an eyebrow. You just accept it as part of your life. And I think that's the perfect home environment for outcasts like us.
Yeah. And I noticed, like, I have a few British friends. I have a few neighbors that I quite hold dear. And they also, like, their parents are from somewhere else. They feel like outsiders, even though to me they're insiders.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I think I'm always going to gravitate towards people that don't feel like they fit in, and them to me, that's how it appears.
It's the magic of London.
Yeah.
Creating bubbles to make others believe that they're insiders now. Whether they are, that's debatable. I'm going to stop here.
Okay.
It's so nice to have you on the podcast. I'm so happy I didn't let myself convince you you shouldn't be a guest. This is one of the most enjoyable chats I have on this podcast. Before we go for our lunch day, how can people find you on social media?
My social media is Spring Day Comedy or Spring Day Comedian. I think I might be actually changing it, though, to Spring Catherine Day Comedy or Comedian, because Spring Day is an algorithmic nightmare.
My God, your first name and your middle name rhymes with Special K. Make sure you type in comedy when you try to Google Spring Day. Otherwise, you get lots of weather-related pictures.
Oh, it's horrendous. It's absolutely horrendous.
And I didn't know. Spring just told me before the podcast that now one of the BTS hit song is called...
It's called Spring Day in English. In English, it's called Spring Day. And it's a great song, but it's like also I'm older than the song, so... It's a great stage name before the internet. I think I'm going to put my middle name in there just so people know I'm a person. But thank you so much for having me on.
No, I was just counting that I've done 60-ish episodes. You are the third American act I've on.
Oh, wow. I'm honored.
Whether it will be the last, we don't know, because I truly thought you share something so special today. The fact that you're willing to learn Japanese and speak it so fluently, that sets you apart from your compatriots.
I'll tell you, one of my favorite bits was I did the sentence in this grammar dictionary I had. It was like, 私は日本語が話せるどころか一度も勉強したことがありません. Which is, I am far from being able to speak Japanese. I haven't even studied it once. And it was such a great sentence.
That's such a dishonest sentence to be able to speak it. I know, like, you will learn Japanese to a certain level to be able to speak it long and grammatically.
No, but I taught my dad to say it.
Okay, kyo, hondo arigato gozaimasu. Thank you for coming to the podcast. We're going to go for lunch now. And if you like the episode, please follow both of us and the podcast and give us a like or subscribe. Otherwise, have a very nice day and I'll see you next time. Bye.